to me, one of the greatest teachings of the whole Christian message and Christ's life himself centers around this very, very, very simple idea. Very simple idea. It's the idea called I am. If you get I am, you get the whole message. If you don't get I am, you miss the entire message. So to the human consciousness, I am always refers to a historical figure, right? Something in time and space, something you can point to. Most human beings in their human state of consciousness, even when they think of I am about themselves, they think about the body, the mind, what they think, what they feel, what they imagine, what they believe. Human consciousness always takes the I am and makes it into something concrete. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is what's really meant by the I am becoming historical. It becomes about something you can see, so can grasp and think about and talk about. And yet, and to me, when I started my sort of love affair in a certain sense with Christ, it was sort of this historical way too. It was very much tied to a particular person at a particular place in time, because that fit my consciousness as a very young child. It was reflective of where my consciousness was. And we are all only capable of seeing things from our state of consciousness. Very important to remember that. You're only capable of seeing things based on and from your current state of consciousness. That's why we tend to interpret everything down to our level. We interpret everything down to our own consciousness, because really we don't have any choice until our consciousness changes, and then everything looks different. And yet the whole Christian message, in a sense, is this message that's based around I am. Understanding, not just understanding in the mind, that's of very little value. Understanding in the sense of a direct realization, literally an awakening out of human consciousness to spiritual consciousness, one could say. Mm-hmm. And Jesus himself mentions this many, 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 many times. One of the great, wonderful sayings from the Gospel of Thomas has Jesus saying this: one who knows everything else, but who does not know himself, knows nothing. That's a pretty good summation of modern times. We know so much, at least we think we know so much. The modern human mind now has many more facts stuffed in it than it did 2,000 years ago. I mean, it had a lot then. You know, you realize nothing much changes, you know, just the scenery. But there is so much knowledge, and of course, even many in the world of spirituality have this thought: if I just could understand more, if I can cram more spiritual knowledge into my brain, then that will help me find God or awaken to my true nature, awaken to the One. And here it is, you know, 2,000 years ago, Jesus saying, one who knows everything but who does not know himself knows nothing. It's quite a statement. It's another thing that happens when we do not see this gift, this teaching of Christ in its true light. Christ has been made, by and large, to fit what's comfortable for human beings, which makes Christ into sort of a nice, comfy, God-illuminated guy. Right? Being. But if you really look at the message of Christ, you realize that this is not true at all. This was a full-blooded sage, an absolute spiritual and cultural revolutionary of the highest order. It does not fit in well with, and it never did fit in well, as his life proved, never did fit in well and never does fit in well with the conventional ideas of the limited human consciousness. We keep dumbing down Christ to our level, right? To a human level. When we miss that this was somebody that was out to awaken humanity. Make no mistake about it. This was a being who was out to awaken humanity, and it got him killed. And so when we see the power that's actually inherent there in the teaching, in who he was, this was someone of great, great spiritual vitality. Great vitality. This is someone who, as true spiritual awakening often is, didn't fit in. As I say, it ended up getting him crucified. Because it didn't fit into the conventional human understanding of who we are and what God is. This is someone who is actually pushing outside of that boundary. Pushing outside of the conventional boundaries. Someone who had actually woke up from the conventional boundaries. Who had realized the truth of their being and was speaking about it. There's a famous quote in the Gospel of Thomas that probably many of you have heard. And it has a lot of truth in it, if you listen to it. When you give rise to that which is within you, what you have will save you. But if you do not give rise to it, what you do not have will destroy you. If you give rise to that which is within you, it will save you. If you do not, it will destroy you. He's talking about spiritual awakening. If you do not give rise, if you do not wake up that which is within you, that which is within you will destroy you. Does it make sense? Fairly radical statement, wouldn't you say? And yet it's eminently practical, and it is the most obvious thing. We see all around us, when humanity does not bring forth what is within them, when they stay within the confines of a limited human consciousness, it destroys them, or what it really means is we destroy ourselves. Suffering ensues, confusion, and all the chaos that comes as a result of that. So if we do not bring forward what is within us, if we do not bring forward the kingdom, if we do not realize the kingdom within ourselves, if we do not do that, then what is within us will destroy us. Now, like any good teacher, he's saying things for emphasis. As I often say, that a spiritual teacher's job is not to give a coherent theology. And it was certainly not Jesus' intention to give a coherent theology, because all you got to do is read what he said rather than what people said about him. But what he said, there's no current coherent theology in there. A spiritual teacher's job, the teaching itself, is a strategy. It's a strategy to wake you up. That's what a spiritual teacher does. Their teaching is not a coherent theology. It's not a philosophy. It's not even ultimately a statement of truth, because someone who is even slightly awake knows beyond any doubt that you cannot put the truth into words. You cannot put what you've realized into words. So someone who's truly awake is going to waste little, if any, time whatsoever trying to put what they've realized into words, into a coherent system of understanding. Their words are strategies to wake the listeners up. Make sense? That's a very different usage of words. And that's why when we take religion, spirituality, historical, we're all, the mind is always looking for sort of a coherent understanding of everything. When the words are themselves, they're not meant to give you a coherent understanding of things. They're meant to break down the way the conventional mind views things. They're meant to poke holes in the conceptual mind so that that light of understanding, that light, the divine light, can actually get through those gaps. True spiritual teachers of enlightenment are out there trying to create gaps in those who are around them through which the divine light can come through. And so when you hear things that, especially that in this case, Jesus is saying, he's trying to create gaps in your understanding. You notice he's always saying what you don't expect him to say. He's speaking sometimes in riddles. Of course, they're only riddles to the uninitiated. Uninitiated means unenlightened. When your consciousness wakes up, then that which seemed like a total riddle actually becomes patently obvious. So to me, this whole celebration of the birth of Christ, which is also the birth of I Am, one's true nature, that's what the birth is trying to show. That's what this whole time we're in, that's the celebration that this point in the tradition, in the Christian tradition, Christmas is the celebration of that birth, right? The birth of Christ. And what have most of us been taught our whole lives? We've been taught the history of it. It happened in a manger, and there was wise men around, there was this, and that. It sets this historical figure as if that we come to spiritual consciousness through a study of history. You see what I mean? And yet that's what's come down to us. And then we worship the history, and we get all hung up in the history. And we miss the most vital thing, that which is really being offered. Like I said when I started, that this life and these teachings of Christ have evolved as my own consciousness has evolved. And what they seem to be 20 years ago, I do not see them that way in any way whatsoever. And certainly when your consciousness wakes up, when you go from functioning from human consciousness to spiritual consciousness, from the consciousness of separation to that consciousness which sees all as one, it's immediately obvious what this virgin birth is. Because when that moment happens, when awakening happens, that grace that happens, not because of you or me, but in many cases in spite of us, when that moment of real deep awakening happens, it is very much like a virgin birth. Because what's birthed in your consciousness is that consciousness, that spiritual consciousness, which is not a product of the coming together of opposites. That's a human birth. Man, woman, come together, do-do-do-do-do. Do, 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 do. Do whatever they do. And then we have these human forms, and that's wonderful. That's a gift too. But for the moment, that's not what I'm focusing on. That is a birth too. That's the birth of form. But a virgin birth is it should be saying something else. It's not actually about, do you believe that Christ was born from a virgin? Only a consciousness that's stuck in history even cares about that. It's of no consequence whatsoever. What is of consequence is when it's happened in you, when it's already happened in you, you know immediately what's being spoken of here. You know that it's not somebody 2,000 years ago, it's you. It's your birth. It's that moment when spiritual consciousness wakes up and it's immediately known this is not the pairs of opposites. This has nothing to do with mommy and daddy coming together. That was given, gave me my human form, and that's a gift, and that's a grace in and of itself. And in that gift of human form, often, almost always, consciousness goes into a trance of this gift of human form, of the coming together and the manifestation of opposites. And consciousness or spirit forgets about its true form, which is formless. And so when that virgin birth happens, something awakes in you. So it's not so much in you, it is you. What you are awakens, and what you are that awakens is that which was always, 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 always eternally awake. I call it the gaze of eternity. And this is really the virgin birth. It's not only the virgin birth, it's the birth of Christ. Christ is very different from Jesus. Jesus is the man. Christ is the consciousness. The consciousness functioned through the man, but the same Christ consciousness can function and does function everywhere. So the Christ consciousness woke up in a guy or a baby, depending on how you want to view it, called Jesus. But the Christ consciousness is one. There's only one consciousness. There's only one spiritual consciousness. Not two, not three, not four. It's not old and it's not new. There's one spiritual consciousness. And only one. And when that wakes up through your humanity, it feels like you're born again. That's what it feels like. Except nothing's actually born because nothing's come into form. It's the acknowledgement, it's the realization, it's the awakening that's born. But it feels like something new, something fresh. It's always been, but your recognition of it has just started. This is a beautiful, this is one of my favorite quotes from the Gospel of St. Thomas. Blessed is the one who exists before they were born. If that doesn't tell it, I don't know how much clearer you can make it. That's something that supposedly Jesus said. Blessed is the one who existed before coming into being, is the actual quote. Blessed is the one who existed before coming into being. In Zen, we have this phrase that's given to students to work on. It's a koan. A koan is a riddle that's not solvable in your thinking mind. But it totally solves itself when you wake up. Kind of like this. This is a koan. This is a riddle. Blessed is the one who existed before coming into being. A mind could go crazy with that. In Zen, they have a very similar question, or they put it in the form of a question, and you're supposed to go meditate on it. Who were you before your parents were born? It's the same idea. It's trying to spark the exact same recognition. Who were you before you came into being? Such statements like this are actually a way of redirecting consciousness away from its obsession with form, its trance with form. And when you, it doesn't need to be directed anywhere else. As soon as it comes out of the trance with form, then that's the virgin birth. Then consciousness immediately recognizes, oh, this is what I have always been. And always doesn't mean like from the time I was born. Always means always, always. It's timeless. That's why I call it the gaze of eternity. It's ever was. Mm-hmm. The great Zen master Bankei called it the unborn. And even though everything in the world comes into form or is born, it's being informed and it's an expression of the unborn. And so everything in form is an expression of that which has no form. And so it goes. And so this statement, blessed is the one who existed before coming into being. This is a statement that's meant to shock consciousness out of its trance. Mm-hmm. Things like this are not spoken from somebody who's coming up to the normal state of human consciousness, which is completely asleep at the wheel, right? Completely asleep at the wheel. And saying, it's okay. Everything will be okay. Just believe this. Just think this. It'll all be okay. If you read the statements of Jesus, you realize it's just the opposite. He's saying, it's not okay. If you don't bring forward what is within you, then what is within you will destroy you. It can't get much more not okay than that. Right? It's like saying to humanity, wake up or perish. This isn't like, you know, a spiritual Sunday school talk, right? It'd be kind of, you said to the little kid, you know, wake up or perish, honey, you know. Actually, my guess is about half of them would probably have already known that. Yeah, like, yeah, glad you're getting on to it now. So these are really, really, these vital teachings are really constantly pointing to awakening when you see them in their true light. And of course, the historical mind of normal human consciousness, the first thing it wants to know, because it's so trapped in time and becoming, it wants to be told, how do I do that? But if someone's asleep, how do you tell them to wake up? Throw water on them, that's better. Give them a few raps on the head with your knuckles. They may wake up. You see, how do you explain to someone who's totally sleeping in a dream how to wake up? They're not listening anyway. And even if you do, and this is, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. It's kind of wild if you ever do. If you've ever been with somebody who's having a dream, and if they talk, and if you say anything back, they tend to incorporate what you said into their dream. You know, they're dreaming about something and then they hear your voice and you can tell it's being incorporated into their dream state. And this is the difficulty that any spiritual teacher, whether it was 2,000 years ago or today or tomorrow, has had, is that it's like whispering into the dreaming ears of a human, of a being, and no matter what you say is incorporated into their dream state. You see what I mean? Which doesn't usually help them wake up. It actually, it just makes it more fascinating, so they stay more asleep. And we see this all the time in spirituality, right? You notice that Jesus in these sayings, and anywhere for that matter, you won't find him saying, here's how to do it, folks. It's like he's walking up to people and rapping them on the head with his knuckles a few times and just saying, wake up. And maybe they're really groggy. They just barely wake up and they go, how do I do that? Just wake up. See, because the how means I'm actually still interested in sleeping. There isn't a how to wake up. It just happens. When your consciousness is no longer interested in being asleep, then you wake up. Basically the way it happens. That's why so many spiritual teachings and teachers of enlightenment are actually constantly undermining the conceptual framework in which most people exist. Because without undermining it, people will keep falling back on it. And therefore falling more and more and more to sleep. In John, where Jesus says, no one can see the kingdom unless he is born again. No one can see the kingdom. The kingdom is the kingdom of oneness. It's the perception of perfect unity. It's perceiving that all things are of one being. And you are that one being. Beingness. That's the perception. That's what happens in that moment when you really wake up. All things are expressions of your own self, of your own being. Not your own self as an ego, not at all. But your own self as the one. All things are expressions of yourself, yourself which is the one. And unless you're born again, that's the new birth. That's that feeling sense. It makes no sense in thinking about, well, what's born again. And it's getting to this whole sort of historical, conceptual way of thinking. And it's of no use whatsoever. This statement is made to an awake being. And he's speaking to other people who have awoken. And it's all, he's also speaking to people that haven't, saying, if you don't awaken, you can't see the kingdom. Because the kingdom is the awakening. The awakening is the kingdom. They are one and the same. You can't think yourself to the kingdom. You can't imagine the kingdom. You can't make yourself good enough to enter the kingdom. The only way to enter the kingdom is to wake up and realize you were always in the kingdom, because the only thing that exists is the kingdom. And yet, if we're not born again, which isn't what it's sold as a lot of times, which is sort of a very sort of emotional sort of, you know, I don't know, conversion or something. This isn't a conversion. This isn't, oh, yes, I'm born again, I'm a Christian now. That's a conversion. Conversion and born again are totally different. They're often mixed up and called the same thing. But born again is the direct realization of that which is not born, which is forever unborn, unformed. And it's within everybody in this room right now. Everybody in this room is the unborn, is the unformed, is unadulterated spirit. And it's only a thought that's believed that makes you think or feel otherwise. Because it's not possible to be what you're not. And when you see that your nature is the unborn, that's the virgin birth. All opposites emanate from that great mystery of being. And when that mystery wakes up, When the mystery wakes up, there's no such, you don't solve the mystery of being. It's the mystery of being awakens as your own being. And if the mind says, I do not understand this, I say, of course, mind, this is not meant for you to understand. No mind can understand this. It's not meant for the mind. If I was going to speak to minds, I would, I don't know, give a sermon or something. Or speak somewhere else, I suppose. But it's not speaking to minds. It's speaking to that which in each of you already knows. As I often say when I teach, everybody knows that whoever they imagine themselves to be, everybody has some little point of intuition where you realize that who you imagine yourself to be, who you present yourself to be, is not at all who you are. Everybody knows that. Most people are terrified of knowing it. The person I think of myself as, I actually know that I'm not. Oh, good Lord, what would I do if I let myself know that? Good Lord, what if I let myself see that the person I present myself as is not at all who I am? It's a fabrication. So the person I present to the world and the person internally I present to myself is not me at all. There's an intuition of that in everybody. Most people are terrified of it. Covering it over as fast as they possibly can. And often using spirituality to do the covering. Creating spiritual egos instead of seeing through egos. This next saying of also, most of you have already heard from John, I am the way, the truth, and the light. No one comes to the Father except through me. It's one of the greatest statements in the whole of biblical teaching. I am the way, the truth, and the light. No one comes to the Father except through me. And yet, although it's one of the most sublime and beautiful teachings of the whole Bible, it is probably the statement that has led to the most horrendous misunderstanding. Because the human mind takes it as conceptual, takes it as historical, because that's the only way terms it can think in, right? Me, this guy named Jesus 2,000 years ago. It's me, folks. Come through me or you're destined to rotten hell. Well, what makes you think that if somebody said it now, you'd think they were completely an egotistical, crazy lunatic? Why do you take it as more true if somebody said it 2,000 years ago? I'll tell you why. Because you're taught to. You're conditioned to. You're brainwashed to. Because, and it's not anybody's fault, it's just that's the way human mind works. It sees things in terms of time, history, persons. It's trapped in the world of form. It's caught in form. That's the only way it can operate, is in the world of form, you see? It's the only thing it can do. The conceptual mind. Oh, sure, it can have its concepts of what's beyond form, but it's just, those are just more, that's just more imagination. But it's the statement, I am, it's the great mystery of the biblical tradition. It keeps showing up. God said it, right? I am that I am, when asked what God is. And Jesus is using I am statements constantly. And yet, these are not referring to the historical person. It's like if you stood up as an ego and said, I am the way, the truth, and the light, they would, you know, either they just leave you alone and get far away from you, Or they might put a little straitjacket around you and take you to a padded room until you got over such silly nonsense. If this I am is taken as a separate thing, me as opposed to anybody else, that's the trance. The true I am is universal. It's the universe, it's the I am of consciousness itself. It echoes within the very heart and soul of spiritual consciousness. It's the sense, I am. It's not the I am of ego. It's not the I am of a separate entity. It's the I am of spirit itself. It's the recognition of that spirit has with itself. It's the declaration of the existence of the one spirit. And when it wakes up in you, you can feel it. Just this, it's that I am, and it's not personal. It comes from consciousness itself, from spirit itself. And if you really look at the teachings of Jesus, he's always, always pointing to this. Constantly pointing to this. He said at one point, you know, all these things and more shall you be able to do. All these things that he's doing and more. It's a way of him saying, don't get hung up on the form, folks. Because all these things that I do, you will be able to do all these and more. It's a way of saying, don't get hung up on the form, on the historical person. It's what's flowing through the historical person. That's what it's about. It's the I am within all beings. When you feel that sense of I am-ness, I am, and there's, you don't complete the rest of the sentence, not I am this, I am that, I am man, I am woman. That's all the limitation of human consciousness, which operates in separation. But I am, that's the echo of consciousness itself. That's the echo of spirit. And that is the truth, the light. All things occur within the light of consciousness, within the light of spirit, within the great I am. All things are expressions of the I am of spirit. The I am is eternal. And as I said, even though this sayings like this are sublime, when your consciousness is awake enough to perceive it, you just get it. It's sort of like when I was in the Zen, when I was studying Zen tradition very much, and all of a sudden, quite out of my own willfulness, for no credit of my own, all of a sudden this awakening happened, and all of a sudden, in the snap of a finger, I immediately understood all these sort of sutras that we had been chanting, sutras that, you know, don't make any sense to the rational mind. And I would think, why are we chanting this? You know, this makes no sense at all. But of course, you try to make it make sense, right? And then you read spiritual philosophers who it seems like they know what they're talking about, because they'll talk very eloquently about it and write very eloquently. And then you wake up and you realize they don't know what they're talking about. This was actually the most simple thing in the world. And I couldn't believe it. I went back and I looked at all these sutras that I had chanted. And I went, good Lord, I know exactly what they're talking about. It's not hidden. It's not obscure. It was the most obvious thing. Oneness is the most obvious thing. It's not the least obvious. Everybody's looking for some like spiritual needle in a haystack. You know, they're meditating and following some thread that they think is going to lead them to God, when actually it's like, open your eyes. Look at where you are. Look at what you are. What you're searching for is what you already are. Stop looking for needles in haystacks. You get the feeling? Yeah, right? That's the amazing thing, and some of you have realized that. When you realize that, you realize, I've been searching, you don't think of it this way beforehand, but you're searching for a needle in a haystack, searching for the thread that's going to lead you to oneness. And then, quite by grace, the awakening happens. And it's like, no wonder I couldn't see it. I was looking for a needle in the haystack, and the one was the haystack. It had to be, because it's all one, right? Can't get a bigger haystack than that. It's all one. And then you sort of hit your forehead going, how did I miss myself? Now there's the real mystery, you know. Waking up isn't a mystery at all. Actually, going to sleep, now that's a mystery. That's impressive. It causes a lot of suffering, but it's extraordinarily impressive that it can happen at all, you know. How I managed to be asleep for so long is something that is still far beyond my comprehension. But misunderstanding this statement, I've said many times when I teach, the closer a statement is to the truth, the more dangerous it is. No statement, no words are the truth themselves. That only comes as the realization. But some words, some statements are much closer and some are much farther away. The closer they are, the more dangerous they are. And this is a perfect example. I am the way, the truth, and the light. That's about as close as words can come. Because when that awakening happens, that's what you feel. You're everything and nothing. That's the paradox. You feel as if you're everything, all universes are contained within you, all levels of existence are contained within you, and yet you feel extraordinarily humbled because you also simultaneously feel as though you are nothing. You are less than a grain of sand on the infinite oceans. And I could never reconcile that in anybody's mind except to say, you find that for yourself. That's the experience. That's how it feels. And so because statements, the closer they are to truth, the more dangerous they are. They're beautiful in that they're vastly powerful to shock consciousness into awakening. But when taken by the human mind, they're extraordinarily dangerous. And this is a good example. Extraordinarily dangerous, because then the human mind comes along and says, Jesus, the guy who lived 2,000 years ago, that guy and only that guy is the doorway to God. And that, before you know, then you have crusades and wars, and you have millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people quite dead. Very dangerous. Which is why in most traditions, the most powerful teachings were withheld from the disciples until they had undergone a long process of spiritual maturing, because they knew if we give these teachings to the human mind, the human consciousness, it's going to do terrible things with them. There is an understanding of that. And so in many, many traditions, the deeper teachings, the teachings that were really meant to awaken and enlighten people, you had to sacrifice family and friends. You had to go into the monastery. You had to be there for 10 years, 15 years, washing dishes, you know, before anyone would even give you the deeper teachings. That's not the way it is today. You know, you can get those exact same teachings for, you know, $12.95 at the local bookstore. So it's all out of the bag. course, it was out of the bag 2,000 years ago, and look what the human mind did with that. But nonetheless, it's still an exquisite expression of truth. Exquisite. From the Son of God. But you happen to be the sons of God too, and the daughters of God. Now here's Jesus in Matthew speaking to a group of people saying, "You are the light of the world." And he's turned it around, right? And John is saying, "I am the light of the world. I am." He's talking from the great universal I am. And then at another point, he turns it around. "You are the light of the world. You, 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 you are," which is, "you are as I am. I am the light of the world, and you are the light of the world." Mm-hmm. But what happens when we get challenged like this from a very awake being? We reinterpret it so that it means something that it didn't mean in the first place, or we just dismiss it. And yet this is like a challenge from Jesus, from the Christ. "You are the light of the world." It's not different from Ramana Maharshi saying, "You are not your thoughts, you are not your feelings, you are not your mind," which is what the Buddha said also. "You are not all these things. You are not this. You are not that. You are not. You are not. You are not. You are not." It's the great tradition of neti-neti, not this, not that. Until it erases everything, finally. Until your identification with everything is erased, and all that's left then is the light of being. The clear light of being. Of course, in this phrase, Jesus is going straight through and just saying, "You are the light of the world." He's going straight to the heart of the matter. "You are the light of the world." Not the ego that would love to be the light. Right? Not the ego that goes, "Me? Oh, I always wanted to be. Thank you." Mm-hmm. That's a very, remember, the more true the teaching, the more dangerous, right? There's nothing more scary than a, you know, supposedly enlightened ego. Than an ego running around saying, "I am the light of the world." That's, you know, that's insanity. As St. John of the Cross said in his great poem at the very end, "And when you come to the possession of the all, you must possess it without wanting anything." It's like saying, when you realize you, yourself, you are the light of the world, you must possess that realization without wanting anything. It means your ego cannot touch it. It's not meant for ego. It's meant for your true nature. Because if your ego touches it, and if your ego claims it, it'll be a disaster. Because when you realize you are the light of the world, what you suddenly realize is everybody and everything is the light of the world. Everything and everybody is the light of the world. That's the experience. It's not an explanation. It's not a theology. That's the direct experience of awakening. It feels like, it literally feels like, not only feels there, you know that the One is awake. Therefore, everything is awake. Everything is the One. Everything is awake. And the human mind would go, "Well, I'm not." Which is the dreaming mind trying to wake up, right? The dreaming mind doesn't wake up. The dreaming mind dreams. When we come into that consciousness of spiritual awakening, what we realize is that spiritual consciousness has always been awake. It could not go to sleep. It could not be defiled. It could not be corrupted. It was not waiting for anything to happen. It was not waiting for us to get our act together. It was not waiting for us to change in a particular way. It was waiting for us to wake up. It's one of the things I loved about Jesus' teaching. If you read them and you really keep your ears open, you realize there is this sense, you just feel this transmission of nowness. You feel it in everything he says. It's all about right now. It's almost so now that you almost sense a sense of urgency. He is not saying you can become the light of the world. He's saying you are. He's speaking directly to the spiritual consciousness. As I often say when I teach, I am not speaking to your mind. Minds tend to listen to me, which can tie them in knots. But I'm not speaking to your mind. And Jesus wasn't speaking to anybody's mind. Speaking to the essence of what you are. As you sit in this room right now, if anybody imagines themselves to be anything other than the light of being, pure spirit, it's just imagination. It's just something that the mind has been taught to imagine. And so really the heart and the soul of spirituality is coming out of imagination. See? And the difficulty is that as soon as our spirituality, our religion becomes historical, it puts us back into imagination. When the real message is the message of come out of imagination. See what you are. Bring your attention back to itself. Let your mind be bewildered. Don't try to make sense. What's looking through you already is that spiritual consciousness, that divine know-thingness. It's already listening. It's already looking out through your eyes. The rest is just imagination. It's just the mind saying, I am blah, 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 blah. That's the trance. I am 40 whatever years old or 50. I am this. I have this color hair. I have this background. My parents are so-and-so and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's the trance. That's why Jesus said, no one gets to heaven unless you are born again. The virgin birth. You got the birth of the opposites when you were born into this world. You got that one. That's beautiful and that's a grace too. But there's another birth. That's the virgin birth. That's the birth of the unborn, the undying, the uncreated. It is when silence recognizes itself. And so the true I am is the ineffable, unseen, intangible consciousness, spirit. Everybody knows there's something about themselves that they can't quite touch, right? You can't quite grasp. You can't quite think about. You can't even imagine. There's something about yourself that always eludes all these attempts, is there not? That's the ineffable. What you cannot grasp is spirit. What you can grasp is but a manifestation of spirit, which is beautiful and divine in its own right. But if it's not seen from its source, then it causes a trance to ensue. So this is really, to me, the heart of the whole Christian message. I am one who knows everything else, but who does not know himself knows nothing. As I've said before, it was part of my own spiritual search itself, was that as well. Seeking, 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 trying to do this right, trying to do that right, trying to meditate right, trying to have no desires, which is a desire in and of itself. It's the highest form of desire, the desire not to have desires. Trying to do it all right, doing what spiritual seekers do. And then one day, I just, quite by grace, right? Everything that's worthwhile happens pretty much by grace, right? It happens when you take a break. Or you are broken, one or the other. But quite by grace, the thought occurred. I'd never thought the thought before. Not this thought. And the thought was, I don't even know who I am. How do I know if I'm doing any of this correctly? How do I know anything? On what basis am I chasing God if I don't even know who I am that's chasing? Or I would have said at that time, seeking enlightenment. I realized I don't even know who I am that's seeking enlightenment. Maybe I should put first things first, huh? Maybe I ought to find out what I am. And everything changed. The whole shift changed, because up until that point, imagination was leading me, was dragging me around on a spiritual search, like a dog on a chain. Completely asleep at the wheel, thinking that I wasn't. And then just with one little thought, one little question came in from somewhere. I don't even know who it is that's on the search. Shocking. I'm trying to meditate well. I don't even know who it is that's trying to meditate well. It's like having the whole rug pulled out from underneath you. Of course, that's the last thing the ego wants, right? It's trying to put many rugs underneath your feet. Even when it pretends like it's trying to pull them away. So this question actually started to open everything up. What am I? Who's sitting here right now? Really? No thought. No image. No complicated theology. If I don't know what I am, I have no basis on whatsoever to judge or think I know anything. Do you see how this comes and can hit you? I don't know, hit me when I saw that. Because I realized I don't have any basis on which to make an opinion, to form an idea about anything if I don't even know who I am that's forming it. Wow, what a shock that was. As Jesus said, if you don't know who you are, you don't know anything. You can't know anything. And of course, he's saying that to shock human consciousness out of its trance a bit. Like, I can't know anything? Well, I'm trying to get to God through knowing everything. I'm sitting here thinking I know things. That's what the human consciousness says, right? That are useful to me. So-and-so says them, therefore they're true. How do you know? You don't even know who you are. Do you see how this, it's like these little grace moments come into us, do they not? They come in, they hit you. Of course, what do we usually do? We usually pull the covers up as quickly as possible and pretend like it didn't really happen, so we can get along with our conditioned way of doing everything. But of course, those moments that happen for everybody in their own way, happen for you, those are moments of grace. That's when something is getting beyond the tightly constructed veil within consciousness. A little bit of light is coming through. Love. That's the fruit of realizing what we are, that we realize that what we are is love. Not the love of human consciousness. That's a sorry imitation of real love. Compared to real love, what we've been conditioned love is just a narcissistic disaster. Compared to spiritual love, which is something very different, much more sublime. Once you've tasted spiritual love, the other, you really can't go back to it. It's just not worth much. Once you've tasted that spirit, that love which is truly selfless, that truly loves for no reason, with no condition, that love that does not know how to not love, that love, it doesn't matter what would happen, that love does not know how not to love. That love, that spiritual love, that which comes through the recognition of our own self, what we really are, that love. So that kind of love, that where Jesus, at the moment of crucifixion, the most horrendous kind of death imaginable in many ways. And if you can imagine putting yourself there in that position, put yourself up on the cross, put a few nails through your hands. I don't mean to be too graphic. I mean, it is a celebration after all, but it's the central theme of the whole Christian message, right? The cross and all that. Put yourself there for a moment. Put yourself there with the guards and the warriors that are there to put you up there. And accuse you of something that in your mind you had nothing to do with. Totally falsely accused. Not only falsely accused. You know how people get upset when they get falsely accused? When nothing's even going to happen to them. I didn't say that. And people can get really upset, right? Just think, you're not just being falsely accused. You're being killed for being falsely accused. Now, what does spiritual love say there? Right? What does spiritual love say there? Forgive them, for they know not what they do. That's spiritual love. That's its first intuition. Because it knows that that's true. It knows that nobody does anything that causes suffering unless they're asleep to truth. That's where it comes from. It comes from asleepness. Right? That's where it's birthed from. And from spiritual love, from the spiritual insight, forgive them, for they know not what they do. They don't. You stop blaming the dreaming world. You don't expect it to do anything other than what it does, which is to dream. And yet there's so much love for it. Is there not? That's what comes streaming out of you, is that great love, that great good fortune of existence itself. And ego is even afraid of that love. Because that love loves things that ego doesn't love. Or as I say, you end up loving things you don't even like. You love people that you don't like. You can't turn it off. True love, you just can't turn off, right? You literally can't. I sometimes wonder, do people actually want what I'm talking about? Sometimes yes, sometimes I don't know. Right? Do you actually want a love that you cannot turn off? Like it's a hose that there is no, you know, little switch that goes, so-and-so mistreated me. I will be resentful and bitter and nasty and, you know, and maybe if they're lucky in 10 years, I'll forgive them. That's what ego thrives on, right? But spiritual love is that which in you that can't turn itself off, that doesn't, that cannot close itself down to anything or anybody. That's the fruit of our awakening. There is no explaining that love. Priya, yeah, come on up.
Recently got a letter from Fred that I just thought would be perfect to share an excerpt here.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
So for those who don't know who Fred is, he's a man who wrote The Office for a copy of the book, Adia's first book, and then awoke. And he sits with about 9 or 10 guys now, I think, and they call, this year they named themselves Still Point Sangha. I kind of think of them as our sister Sangha, so I thought it'd be nice to bring them here. Mm-hmm. And, well, the story, very one sentence, is that he went in at 18.
Went into prison. He's in prison, for those who don't know.
He's about 40-something now, mm-hmm. and his first chance of parole, he'll be 70. So he'll have been in 50 years. Okay. So.
Finding freedom within a prison. Which I think he calls his temple or his monastery now. Mm-hmm. The wisdom of no escape. Yeah.
Life has been going on with all of its ups and downs, an infinite variety of scenes, while under it all, I remain the same. It isn't hard to understand why so many who have awakened have retreated from the active world and gone into silence. Once the underlying truth is tasted, all of the drama in the world is seen as simply that, drama. Don't misunderstand, it's still entertaining, but you're not really a part of it anymore. And simply basking in the light of that which underlies it all is so much more engaging. And here's the part that seems like the Christmas story he's giving us. My family has gotten a little bigger since I last wrote you. A little mouse has come to live with me. She's just a little baby, so small she could sit on a quarter. She also has some sort of birth defect that manifests as something similar to Down syndrome. I don't think she would have made it long living on her own. I've named her Lakshmi, after a Hindu goddess. And she's such a sweet little thing, such a precious life. She's sitting here with me now, munching on a cracker. And needless to say, she has stolen my heart. The rest of her family lives just outside my door, in a hole in the wall. There's a bunch of them, and they're all shapes and sizes. They're in and out of my cell just about every night, so I usually leave something to eat by the door. And then, just one more paragraph. So then he had to stop, and then he picks it up a little later, and he says, Lakshmi is here in the hollow of my collarbone watching me write. The thing about opening one's heart to another is that it is just a natural occurrence which happens only in the here and now. Just like the awakening experience, the moment that the mind brings past or future into play again, the flow stops. This is because real and true love come from beyond the mind. It comes from that and simply is what it is. The same is true with the awakening. Many people experience a taste of it and then try to hang on to that. But this is impossible because the experience itself moves into the past, whereas the self is always here, always now. To stay always in the now is to flow with it from moment to moment and discover the multiplicity of colors and flavors that it has.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Fred. I always love hearing from Fred. Mm. And what a great teaching he is. And he actually fits right in with the tradition that I came from in Zen. Zen has its wonderful, holy appearing beings and very noble and beautiful sort of saints. It has that like most religions do. And also some of the greatest patriarchs of the whole tradition that carried the tradition along were also some very nasty characters at some point in their life. Criminals, murderers, thieves, bank robbers. And yet, even them, the people that one thinks they'll never wake up, they couldn't possibly. They don't deserve it. And in the tradition I came from, we have a whole host of supposedly people who don't deserve it waking up anyway. Which it's really it shows to the nature of truth itself. The nature of awakening is that awakening is not earned. It's not merit gained. Whatever is necessary to turn our attention back to its source is what's given. If it's being here on a wonderful evening celebrating this wonderful, beautiful, sacred time of year, then that is what's given. If it's given, if it is to receive a more or less life sentence in prison, then that is what's given. Whatever we need is what's given. And people wonder, what do I need? Your life, that's what it is. You're given everything you need. Every bit of your life, the best of it and the worst of it, that's exactly the self's return to itself. And in the end, why complain about the road taken? It doesn't matter what the road is taken. This is it. Fred reminds me of a great Tibetan teacher who spent 70 years in a rock hut chiseling sutras in stone tablets, right, in Sanskrit. And someone came to him once and said, and he also had lost his legs as a child, and that's how he ended up in this hut, doing nothing but carving sutras into stone tablets. And someone came and said, gosh, that must have been a disaster to lose your legs so young, and you almost never have left this hut for the past 60 years. That must be so difficult. And he said, no, 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 no. He said, that supposed accident which took away my legs put me in this hut where I could not escape myself. And it was through being in this hut, not being able to escape, this was the impetus for my own realization. So everybody's life, whatever it looks like, is actually exactly written for exactly what we need. Freedom breaking out in prison. What would be a better Christmas gift than that?